This is June Singer, Archetypes, Eternal or Evolving. This was recorded in 1984. Tape 2 of 3.
They knew who everybody was but that last anima figure, Gomer. She is the wife of Hosea the prophet, and Hosea is commanded to take a prostitute for a white wife. You'll read about that in the book of Hosea if you're so inclined. I would like to start with asking you about any questions that have come up over the time you've had to get away and possibly reflect a bit before we go into the afternoon's presentation. Yes, please. Yeah, the point about the Archimedean point outside of the psyche was that while you're in the midst of something, you can't really see it. And we've never been able to see the whole world picture while we're standing on the earth. And we've always seen ourselves as surrounded, being at the center. First of all, ourselves being the center of the earth and everybody around us being somehow threatening. But then when you get outside of the earth, you can look and see the unity of it. It's only when you get beyond something that you see it as whole. When you're in the midst of it, you look here and see a part, and there and see a part, and so on. Okay? Yes. I think that that image is one of the most striking examples of the kind of thing that happens in the material world that alters consciousness. To have real enlightenment, to be able to sit in front of your television set and suddenly you're not on the world anymore, you're out there looking in. Yes. Well, what you said contained a clue. We can't get outside of our own thinking. We can't get out of it by thinking about it. You're quite right. But there are other ways to reach it. And one way is through images, like this particular image that we're talking about. Another way is through meditation, which releases us from the logical process and allows that mystery to flow in a different way. So the superconscious, then, is a symbolic representation of that capacity to get outside of the psyche to view it in the same way that we get off the earth in order to view it. And the space vehicle and television cameras aid us to do that in the physical sense. And there are psychological processes, primarily meditative processes, that enable us to do the same thing for the psyche. In the what other process did you say? You're saying that you don't see how we get outside of that. Yeah. It's possible to have both the, in fact it's absolutely essential to have the perspective coming from looking within and also the perspective coming from looking without. I think that's what Jung is talking about when he talks about the ego perspective and the self perspective. When you're looking from the ego perspective, you have one image of the world of which you're the center. It's comparable to the way astronomers used to conceive the universe with the world as the center. And when you have the self-perspective, then you're outside of the ego and you can look back at the ego and really see yourself as a grain of sand, as a tiny, tiny pinpoint on the earth interacting with lots of other pinpoints, and that's a very different perspective. So the point of all this, it seems to me, the point of Jung's whole theory is to be able to blend these two perspectives and to move back and forth between them, recognizing that they're both true, but that they're different levels of consciousness. No, it's not exactly that. It's not a heightened consciousness. That's what you're talking about. But it's really another level where you're grasping the whole and seeing yourself as a part rather than enhancing your own ego capacity to function. That, I would say, is an expansion of the ego, usually when one is open to unconscious material flowing in. But it's still on the level of functioning in the world, rather than somehow looking at it from a different stance. Okay. Yes. Yes. Yes, Jung did. He, I think, never really understood Eastern meditation, and I'm not going to suggest that I understand it either. But I think that he was suspicious of a place where the ego doesn't function. And in a really deep meditative state, that is what happens. The ego is really put aside. Now, I think that we have to recognize that where Jung was coming from, here is where context is so important. Jung was coming to this perspective in the 1930s when he had made his trip to India and was writing about his reflections, and he had some contact with some yogis, but not a great deal. And Jung, as you remember, had quite a terrific confrontation with the unconscious that he describes in his autobiographical work, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, in which he was almost pulled under. Now, it's like somebody coming to explore a jungle for the first time, and somebody says, well, you ought to go in that jungle with your eyes closed. No way, you know, you've never gone into a jungle. If you were a primitive person, you might be very comfortable about walking into the jungle with your eyes closed because you'd be so attuned to every sound, to the vibrations in the air, that you could handle it. At the time Jung was talking about meditation in the West, nobody meditated in the West. You know? Nobody had ever tried a psychedelic drug. Nobody had ever really let go in the unconscious. There was always this feeling that you've got to hang on. You remember Jung says in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, the thing that really saved me was that every day I had to see my patients, I had to have dinner with my wife and my kids, and so I could really hold on to that ego position. He was very reluctant to encourage people to let go of that ego position for a moment. And I remember also in about 1960 when I was in Switzerland, and I think I talked about this in Boundaries, where I was on a ski trip up on the Jungfrau, and in the place where you go and sit around and have beer, we, a group of us from the Jung Institute, met Dr. Albert Hofmann, the man who discovered, the chemist who discovered LSD, and it's the first I ever heard about it. It was so interesting. I was in the very beginning of these things, and Albert Hofmann was just talking about how Tim Leary and Dick Alpert and Ralph Messner were experimenting with it at Harvard, and he said, you Americans, you know, you don't respect anything. In Europe, this would never be given out to graduate students. It would never be talked about on a college campus. It would be kept very hush-hush. And here, you know, everybody's just playing around with this stuff. You're going to have some terrible things are going to happen. And, you know, maybe he was right. Some terrible things did happen. But at the same time, some people got acquainted with the unconscious in ways That would have made Jung absolutely shudder. But this is familiar territory to us now, to many of us. And we feel relatively at home. I mean, you've all, I'm sure, done guided imagery. I remember when we first heard about active imagination at the Jung Institute, you had to be pretty far along in your training before they even mentioned it. And books on Kundalini yoga were kept in the locked shelves. And you laugh, but really? Really? That's very good. Yes, I've been really interested in that period between death and birth, particularly the prenatal period, and very interesting work that people have been doing, exploring that part of the unconscious that they call past lives, and I don't know if it's a past life or not, but I have seen and participated in experiments where people get into an altered state of consciousness and seem to be experiencing something from another age. Where that's coming from is really hard to say, because most of them, when questioned afterwards, have had no conscious experience in this life that would give them the kind of information that they were able to disclose under this in this trance state. It entirely. But getting out of the point where the ego is central. The ego has got to be there. You can't see without any eyes, you know? You have to have that mechanism of the ego to register. But it's very different, because it's a very small part of the process. It's like we couldn't look at the earth and from the moon unless the mechanisms were on earth to perceive it. But the perception is from outside. It's a kind of a paradoxical thing, and I think when we talk about these things, we have to recognize that we're talking in terms of metaphors and models, and they'll never exactly fit. But they're ways of breaking through a constricted frame of consciousness, and so that's why when we use these terms and talk about a superconscious, I don't expect to be able to prove to anybody ever that there is one. But it's a way of stepping back and looking without being stuck in the same process that we've been going on in. Yes. Yeah, the transcendent functions within the superconscious framework. That is, the transcendent function is a psychic process. It's a way of looking at the ego and looking at the unconscious and moving from one to the other as a base point. With the perspective of the superconscious, you watch that whole transcendent function happening by being outside of it. Okay, yes? Yeah, I don't know that I would call it a more subjective state. I'd rather call it a more objective state. If we have to make a subject-object dichotomy, but really what happens is that you get into a state beyond subject and object, where you watch your thoughts going by and let them go. Let them come, let them go. And know that you're not your thoughts, and you don't get grabbed by them. You don't get into that churning of the chatter of the mind, that you just let the thought happen and sail on through and come back to whatever it is you're focusing on. Yes. But That's right. That's right.
So that in the thousands.
Krishnamurti calls it objectless awareness, which is gives one a sense. It's hard to explain it, but it's easy to experience it. Yes. An individual connects with it. For some, the mother archetype might be very, very powerful. For another, the trickster might be a ruling archetype. It's not in itself that it's so powerful, but it's in that interrelationship that the power comes. Yes. Correct. What I'm talking about. And this is, you know, this is the paradigm process. You take an idea. Somebody has an idea. Plato had an idea. Let's go back. And he expressed it. Then Jung came along, looked at Plato, and got outside of that, coming from another position, and said, this is what Plato is doing, and I'm seeing it in a wider scope. I'm seeing it against the background of my experience. And so he's adding to it. Now, Jung has been gone for over 20 years, and we're coming from another generation, and we're looking at this process of ego and unconscious and the transcendent function, and we're stepping outside of that into what we call now a superconscious, just as Jung stepped outside of the ego to recognize the unconscious. So it's a kind of infinite regression. Somebody's going to come along and say the things that they were talking about in the 1980s, well, now we see those in a wider context. And that's the way that intellectual frameworks get broken through and people move on. Okay, well, another one? Okay, wait. The archetypes, according to Jung's idea, are rather... they're simply there, like the Great Mother, the Virgin, the Hetaira. But every culture will have its different images of them. And we have our movie stars and our stage stars and our ego ideals, our political figures who represent the archetypes, but in the idiom of our culture. Well, I'd like to go on now, and we'll stop again and get into some other issues. But the thing that I want to talk about now is called formative causation. Formative causation. Let me explain what I mean by that. In ancient Greek philosophy, form meant an inner forming activity, which is the cause of the growth of things and of the development and differentiation into different kinds of forms. Actually, that's what I was talking about at the very beginning of our meeting concerning meditation in the garden. I was reflecting on how there's an inner forming activity that causes things to grow as they do. And I'm going to read you a quotation that relates to this. You can turn off the slide projector. I won't be needing it for a while. I'm going to read you this quotation. In an oak tree, formal cause meant the whole inner movement of sap, cell, and growth. The articulation of branches, leaves, and so forth, which is characteristic of that tree and different from that taking place in other trees. This formative cause is not a mere form imposed from without, but rather an ordered and structured inner movement that is essential to what things are. Any such formative cause must evidently have an end product, which at least is implicit. Thus, it's not possible to refer to the inner movement from which the acorn, it's not possible to refer to the inner movement from the acorn giving rise to an oak tree without simultaneously referring to the oak tree that's going to be the inevitable result from this movement. So formative cause always implies final cause. Doesn't this sound somehow like the description of an archetypal process? Interestingly enough, it doesn't come from Jung. It doesn't come from any archetypal psychologist. It comes from a theoretical physicist. The writer is David Bohm. David Bohm, B-O-H-M, a man who has made some important contributions to quantum theory through his work at the University of London. Some people find a relationship between his theories and consciousness research, or the study of how we become aware. Yes? I want to say that David Bohm has studied with Krishnamurti. It's really interesting now. We talked about Jung and his interest in the East and Taoism. Now we're talking about David Bohm, the physicist, and he has also been greatly influenced by Krishnamurti, whose background is Hindu and whose philosophy resembles Taoism. The book by David Bohm that you'll want to look at if you want to pursue this is called Wholeness, W-H-O-L-E, Wholeness and the Implicate Order. If you understand quantum physics, you probably read this book from cover to cover. And if, like me, you don't understand that, you'll read some of the chapters which explain things in terms which anyone who's familiar with Jung would immediately understand. Primarily the first couple of chapters and the last chapter or two are really very helpful in enlarging this framework. Bohm talks about the implicate order which can't be perceived, since what it is implicit. And this morning I purposely used that term to prepare you for a little bit of talking about Bohm, but Bohm is the one who has originated that particular expression of the idea. Bohm says that energy moves between the implicate order and the explicate order. It moves in and through explicate order. Now, explicate order, you remember, is this world. It's the Newtonian world. And what he's saying is that the physics and the psychology and the experience in this touch-see world is informed by another dimension of reality, the implicit. So now let's go back to the Bible a moment. God in Genesis creates Adam out of dust or clay, but that's only a clay image. It's not human until God breathes into Adam. And what does he breathe into Adam? It's not air. He couldn't breathe air into a corpse or a clay jug and have it come alive. But it is what is in the air. And that's the mystical concept, the concept of Ruach, the Spirit of God that hovered over the face of the waters. It's wind, but it's not wind. It's what's called the pneuma in Greek. And the Hindus call it prana, that animating force. The Chinese call it qi or qi, that energy within the energy. I don't know how I can say it better than that, because it's not measurable, but it's the stuff of life, creation. And yet it's not tangible. You can't weigh it and you can't measure it. Now, Bohm calls this force, this energy, which undulates between potentiality and actuality, holo movement. That's what you suggest. And what he says is that the implicate is an order of undivided wholeness where many elements are holistically compressed or folded together. And we have a sense here that everything is compressed in this concept of Ruach, or the unspeakable name of God, the beginning of all things. And through this holo movement, H-O-L-O, movement, outward and inward, what is enfolded or folded up in the implicate order unfolds into the explicate order as discrete and separate elements. So now I have this kind of image. I like to think of images, it makes it easier for me, of a blanket that's all rolled up into this tiny little ball, and that's the implicate order, and then kind of teasing it up and pulling it out, and it shakes out stuff into the world we know, and then that somehow gets folded up at night and it gets back into that tiny little compressed other order of things where we can't see what's there, we don't know what it is, but everything is somehow in it, or the source of it is in it. This implicate order can't be experienced through the senses and through rational knowledge. So if you're having trouble following me or experiencing it, don't feel bad about it. The children of Aristotle couldn't say very much about it, because thinking and sensation just don't make it. It's not palpable or visible. What it takes is intuition, highly trained sometimes, or a meditative mode to be open to what may be revealed. If you wanted to catch an angel, I think you'd have a hard time doing it with a butterfly net, but you might do it with your imagination, and that's what we need to apply here. And this is what meditation is about, to make space for something to come in that is not premeditated or pre-planned. You know, that happens in dreams a lot, because that's a time when we put aside our breaks, our consciousness, our rules and regulations, our motivations and all that stuff, and we just go to sleep. The ego goes to sleep. And then it is that all kinds of wonderful things can pop up in us. The Aristotelian concept that we hear in psychology, that nothing exists in the intellect that was not first in the senses, is the diametric opposite of this idea. I think that if you wanted a more simple explanation or description of holo movement, William Blake is, again, the person to turn to when he says, "See the world in a grain of sand, heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the hand, palm of your hand, eternity in an hour." That he has the right idea there, very simply. One can see also with the inner eye, not reality in the common everyday sense, but one can see through reality. Going from Aristotle to Plato is to make the transition from the explicate order to the implicate order. And you make a similar kind of transition when you go from Freud to Jung. Freud shied away from the mystery of the psyche and the world and wanted to deal with the phenomena that were experienced in the sphere in which they were experienced, which is a perfectly legitimate operation. Jung was willing to press forward, or maybe it was just his personality type or his nature, to press forward into the sphere, into the depths of the collective unconscious, where nothing made any sense and you couldn't write logical books about it. That's the same transition. Actually, Jung was in touch with the implicate order, and Freud with the more explicate order. Plato was concerned with the primordial idea, which was what I think Bohm was talking about in the implicate order. And Aristotle was concerned much more, although each one, Plato and Aristotle, recognized the reality of the other. Aristotle's concern was with dealing with what's here and now. He said, well, there may be something beyond, but like so many scientists today, he would say, well, that's not my specialty and I can't deal with that. So Aristotle stayed with what could be expressed and measured and observed. And it's also the difference between, for example, Descartes, who separated the two realities of spirit and matter, in contrast to Teilhard de Chardin, who saw the unity of all things. Or the difference between Newton, who saw a universe of things and energy, and Einstein, who saw relationships primarily. But to understand that energy that goes between that whole of movement is the essential fact of life. And it's a fact having to do with relationships primarily. Now, the idea of an enfolded and unfolding universe is not particularly new. I found something that I thought might have been the inspiration for David Bohm to use those particular terms. And that was something written in the 15th century by a priest called Nicholas Cusanius, who wrote something called his Visions of God, something that's really quite parallel. The idea that God had a timeless plan of the world in his mind before its realization in matter is consistent with the Christian sacramental view of history. It's related also to Plato's idea of how all things develop out of seeds, what we would call primordial archetypes. Now, in the 15th century, the clock was looked upon with a kind of almost mystical feeling because the clock, which had been newly discovered at that time, was considered to be a model of the divine plan. And this is what Nicholas Cusanius says about it. Let then the concept of the clock represent eternity itself. Then the motion of the clock represents succession. Eternity, therefore, both enfoldeth and unfoldeth succession, since the concept of the clock, which is eternity, doth alike enfold and unfold all things. Only gradually does this idea of a clockwork universe become desacralized. In the 18th century, the clock became an automaton that had no connection with God. So it was really interesting to me, after reading David Bohm's book, to run across this old version of the enfolded and unfolding universe. Bohm is now talking about these in a very different context. I want to say a word about the difference between implicate order thinking and explicate order thinking. What are the characteristics of explicate order thinking? Well, the world is regarded from a mechanistic point of view. The idea is that everything that can be explained, if you only have enough facts to be able to understand what's going on, it's linear. Time is considered as moving from past to present to future. Things, people, and everything that is primary exists independently. They have a fundamental kind of existence. I and you, we're all fundamental facts of life. What is real and what is fundamental is matter, the material world, what the Chinese call the 10,000 things, particles, fields, atomic building blocks. This is a necessary view. We need to have this kind of viewpoint. If we didn't, we couldn't go through our day's activities. We need to deal with separate, definable, discrete objects. But the trouble comes when we limit ourselves and say this is the only view, when we only see fragments of the whole. I think Jung's great contribution was being able to see beyond the fragmentary concept of the world to the self, to the mystery that contains the archetypal patterns. I'll tell you an experience I had in my consultation room the other day. I am a man I've been working with. It's a real challenge to me because he is your, if I could mix the metaphors, your archetypal explicate order thinker. This man is a computer expert, and he thinks that everything can be computerized, and that if only you have enough facts, you can predict what's going to happen. So I said, it's a real challenge to me because I'm trying to get to him and I'm going to do it. So, so this is what happened. He said, you know, I can predict if I have the facts. So I said, well, why don't you predict something right now that you believe you have all the facts you need to predict? So he looked around the room and he said, okay, see that chair over there? Every time I've come in, that chair has been sitting there. And it's sitting there now, and I predict that in 5 minutes it will still be sitting there. I said, fine. You're sure of that? He said, I've got all the information. I said, fine. And I got up and moved the chair about 3 inches away. So that stopped him for a while to see what happens. But the point is, the principle is fine, assuming that you can really know all the variables. But there is always something floating in. Always something. And this is a very simple situation. Imagine trying to predict a complex situation. So unless you recognize that you are living in a world where anything can happen because that universe continues to unfold devilish ideas in the heads of psychotherapists like me and other places, and you just don't know. You can never have a purely mechanistic world. And that's really the difference, one difference between the computer and the human brain. The computer, any of you who have worked with them, understand that the computer does not understand ambiguity. It doesn't understand tricks. It doesn't have a sense of humor. It doesn't understand double meanings. And the human brain has this marvelous faculty of slipping around and through and making all kinds of adjustments that it doesn't have to be programmed for. Now, the implicate order of the world, in this view, Jung's concept of psychic energy seems to carry on where Freud's concept of the libido left off. Freud's psychology was a necessary precedent for Jung's in a certain sense, in that, according to Freud, the ego is the most important part of the human being. And the idea is for the ego to be somehow to become able to grapple with the unconscious and to assimilate as much of the unconscious as necessary. For Jung, the ego was always subordinate to a far greater reality. David Bohm's concept seems to me like Jung's because it gives a much more coherent account of the properties of matter in the psyche by saying that the implicate order is the fundamental one, and the explicate order is derivative. So here we have, in a way, contrast because between the order of the ego and the order of the self. And what Freud is saying, if we want to make this quick translation, is that the world of the ego is the important one, and our task is to build up this ego so that it can deal with a multitude of variables in the world. And Jung is more focused on the multitude of variables, the unlimited number of them, and recognizes that the ego has only a limited capacity to function within that, and that the strength of the ego is not in assimilating the mystery, but in somehow being able to live with it and go with it and move with it and be open to it and not expect to somehow conquer it. Any questions, discussion at this point? Yes, that's a very important point. And I hope that I wasn't implying that it was just sitting up there sending directions to this order. And but I appreciate your saying that and calling our attention to it. It's important at this point because the whole thing is a dynamic process. This whole movement is a movement. If you conceive of the implicate order moving its energy into this explicate order, and the explicate order then moves it back into the implicate order, And we have a constant process in which everything is changing. And as we go on, we're going to see just how this functions. In fact, I was just about to say that in reference to time, for example, the implicate order, in the implicate order, there isn't any past or present or future. It's all there in potential. It's a kind of eternal presence. And when we talk about synchronicity, we talk about simultaneous events occurring and suddenly become aware of them. We're talking about something that might be related to the concept of the implicate order, where all its potentiality seems to be present. Seems to be, I'd say, because this is the way that we're right now conceiving of it, and it might change, as it has changed. And in the explicit order, this order that we're in right now, we experience time as change, and past and future consume us. And we spend most of our time, most of us, being concerned with what we did in the past or what's going to happen to us in the future. And when you look at the question of archetypes from the perspective of the implicate order, the archetypes are always present, they're eternal, and they're there. And when you look at it from the perspective of the explicate order, as you see the world with its manifestations always changing, always new things happening, you can't help but believe that the archetypes themselves are evolving. We're going to see some implications of this later on. Now, I would like to slide, please. How many of you have read my book Androgyny and recognize this? Good, well, not too many, but I bring it up because this was a kind of core thing that happened to me when I developed this image. And I've gone on quite a bit in my thinking about it since I wrote Androgyny. Now, let me just say a few words about the image as I saw it at the time, and then show you how this fits in with what I'm talking about, or what I've been talking about, what I said last night, too, about the four stages of reality, or the four dimensions, rather. Up at the top, well, first of all, you recognize the yin-yang symbol. And up at the top, you see a place where the dark, the yin, begins to give way to the light or the yang around midnight. I'm just imagining this, imaging this as a day. Where that happens, we're preparing for birth. And that midnight area could be the area between death and birth. It could include gestation, beginning where that light starts. And where you see that kind of burst of light, there we have the phenomena of birth or rebirth. We see energy emerging. It's the moment of creation in the beginning. It's the tiny ray of light in the Kabbalah when the Ein Sof contracts and then sends forth this bit of light into the contraction. So here is where the dot, the tittle, the iota from Gnostic literature comes, that creative spark, or the bindu in Hindu mythology. The development of the ego until you get to midday, and then I have this quotation from the I Ching: when yang has reached its greatest strength, the dark power of yin is born within its depths. For night begins at midday when yang breaks up and changes into yin. So this is when in our own lives we have achieved our masculinity or our femininity, and we begin then to move into an assimilation of the opposite, the contrasexual. And in this I'm characterizing that as the yin side. So then we begin the movement, and this is at that state of midlife or maturity, where we're moving no longer toward the light but toward the darkness. And we're moving now upward. Instead of the sun consciousness, we're moving toward the moon consciousness as we become older and we hope wiser. And finally, we're heading toward that midnight. About the time we get to dusk, we have the opposite of dawn. We have the dark night of the soul. We have death. We have the image of the black hole where the stars collapse and are absorbed into nothingness. And we have in mythology the gates of hell or the entrance into the mysterium tremendum. And there again we have womb, because the tomb is the womb of death, so to speak, or the womb of that other world. Now, how does this concept relate to the idea of the implicate and the explicate order? Well, it's really interesting to me because it's so natural to superimpose that idea upon this one that I had been thinking about. And where the dotted line is, I'd call that whole part above that the anti-universe. I didn't know what to call it, because the part below it is the universe as we know it. It's everything of which we are or can be conscious of. And so the other part is that unknowable. And it seemed to me that the top part, and disregard now the proportions and sizes, because the top part is certainly unlimited. The top part would be correspond to the implicate order, that order between the end of consciousness and the beginning of consciousness, between all that we know and the rebirth and the innocence and the beginning to know again. So I don't know if that's clear, if you have any questions about it. On the lower half, you have a continuing movement towards separation. On this side, towards separation and differentiation. And here, we're moving toward unity and integration as we move back toward the implicate order. And I think this is something like what you were suggesting with the idea of that thing constantly in movement. Now, you can liken this to a human lifetime. You can talk about it in terms of a day's experience with the day of consciousness and then the night of unconsciousness. Or you can liken it to a whole growth of a civilization. The model can fit many images. Well, it's not just the circle. The circle is the direction of the movement, but that whole anti-universe just spreads out infinitely. So it's as though that were an unlimited source out of which our knowledge comes, just as though everything that we don't know, and understand I'm talking metaphorically, that everything that we don't know is the source of everything that we do know. Because when we understand something, we haven't created it. We've just somehow pulled it out of the unconscious, like you pull a fish out of the sea. And that's one reason why the ocean is such a wonderful symbol for the unconscious. So we're pulling it out of that infinite space. Yeah, right. Harder, maybe. Yes. Yeah. Well, I was writing. This was in the book on androgyny, and I was making a comparison between the hermaphrodite in which the sexes are not differentiated, where there's a kind of confusion, there's some kind of a physiological anomaly. But with the androgyne, there is a high degree of differentiation, and it's the male and female within a person in a conscious relationship rather than just a confusion. So that was what that represented. Okay. Yes, that certainly could be regarded that way if you're thinking of it in terms of one's own experience, one's lifetime, that you keep going around this path over and over again. You die many deaths. You know, we've all had experiences of taste of death, and then we are reborn again. I know in my life it's happened a few times. I'm sure it's happened to most of you. So, but when you come back within one lifetime, you come back and go through that process on a higher level, so you can look at it as a spiral, certainly. Well, that's nirvana, isn't it? My experience is that I have it and I lose it. And I'll have it and then it'll slip away and I'll find myself getting involved in some petty little nonsense and then I have to say, wait a minute. And I think that that's part of the process of becoming enlightened, and I don't, my experience is that while you turn on the light and suddenly everything is clear, that in a kind of long-term way, you get a little clearer as time goes on, and you hope that you don't get stuck in those little petty things, and you do it less and less, and things bother you less and less as you begin to be able to move quickly from one perspective to another. That's certainly what we're aiming for. So then there's always the image of the moving, of going out and returning. Let's have the next slide. This is the image, Hindu idea of the creator god with the faces of the Brahma, the creator, and the other faces, there are the three faces, I don't know if you can see that clearly there, but to either side of the one that's facing you. One is Vishnu, the preserver, and the other is Shiva, the destroyer. And these three faces in Hinduism also show this cyclic pattern. We have that in the beginning, the birth, there's a creation, and Brahma is in ascendancy there. And then there is Vishnu, the preserving element. And then finally, the destruction as a human person prepares to enter that dark place, that is, as he looks forward to the end of life and to the tomb or the going back. So we have a very similar image to the one that I showed you in the diagram. So let's have another slide, please. So here again we have the same image of going back into the darkness when yin takes over yang. This is an alchemical image of the breaking through from the creative movement at the top through the light half of life, light part of life, and finally the spirit returning to the darkness. And that's an image of the Ouroboros, or Ouroboros, the snake biting its tail. And it's symbolic of the unconscious state when the snake has caught its tail in its mouth and is locked into a position from which nothing can happen. You just can't move on. But here it's been broken open, and then creation can happen, and the spirit, which is represented by the dove, can go move through creation and then move back again into that mystery place that we're calling the implicate order. Next slide. And here's another image of the world emerging as the dream of Vishnu, which is again a sense of coming out of the manifest world, coming out of the world of the dream of the god, which is a really very old and interesting way of dealing with that same idea. And I think it's so fascinating to see that these ideas that are so new are also so old. It really almost makes you believe that there is that patterning, and that it takes many forms and it expresses itself in many different ways in many cultures, but that there must be some basis for this way that idea emerges and expresses itself and then disappears back in the unconscious again. Next slide. Here we have an image of the creation of the four worlds from the Kabbalah, showing that one emerges after another until it finally comes to the world in which humans live. So this is shown in a more linear way, which is not surprising since it's based on a Western model. Next one. Here's the moment when something is breaking through from the primordial chaos, from the implicate order into the order in which we live. And this is an alchemical picture. It's identified as the golden birth of the fetal sun. And I want to show you a modern version of that. Next slide. An image of a human child being born. And then in the mid part of life, the masculine and feminine come into a relationship with each other. Next slide. And here we have the Hindu image of the divine aspect of human sexuality. In the East, these were not separated in the way that they have been in the West. But the human interaction, the human intercourse, was an expression in the manifest world of the intercourse of the gods in the, so to speak, implicate order. Next. Here we have the worship of the divine vulva, the worship of the archetypal feminine, which was always a part of Indian mythology and of many other non-Western faiths, especially Taoism. And the image is, interestingly, it's an image that looks very much like a peach. And you'll notice that in often in images of Chinese philosophers, in statues and sculpture, they're holding a peach. And that is representative of the divine feminine. So it gives us a sense of how we move from the archetypal world to the world of matter and the world of sexuality, from spirituality to sexuality. And it occurred to me as I was thinking about this how the two are related, and that there's an intrinsic contrast between sexuality and spirituality. Next slide. And I went back to my interest in psychological types again, and I thought that this whole focus on sexuality and spirituality might have something to do with typology. That spirituality has a lot to do with intuition, because it's conceptualizing what you can't see. And it's also with intuition that we see beyond the immediate experience into something that draws us, which has a very great power. And sexuality has a very large component of the senses. These are very important in sexuality. So whereas intuition and sensation are widely separated, where intuition and sensation are widely separated, you get a great separation between sexuality and spirituality. And that certainly is true in a large part of our culture. But where in the human personality intuition and sensation are better integrated, there the possibility of seeing the divine in a human partner and bringing that kind of energy into a sexual relationship, which is then experienced as a very deep form of love that goes beyond the personal and accounts for the transpersonal experiences that sometimes occur in loving and sexual relationships. So let's see the next slide. So here we have that Hindu image where the energy that we're talking about moves back and forth between the spirit and the senses. And it could be the kind of energy which transmutes spirit and flesh. And so the seed, the idea of the seed, which is interestingly enough, both in the Kabbalah as a symbol of the sparks of light that emanated in creation, and also the seed becomes a metaphor for semen and for the seed there. And the earth into which the seed falls becomes a metaphor for the female sex organs. So we have these relationships of gods and goddesses in the East, which are symbolic of this union of the spiritual and the sexual. Next slide. We have here the stylized images that are used in Hindu worship. We see the female organs with and without the male, the first one being with the male and the others without. And when the female and the male organs are seen together, the image is that of androgyny, of that intermarriage or that integration of the opposite qualities that can exist side by side in an individual. So if we could turn now to the next slide. This is an image that I had seen in picture books and had always been quite entranced with. And so you can imagine when I was in Bombay a couple of years ago and I went on a tour to the K's rock temple at Elephanta, how I felt when I stood before this image of the god Shiva as androgyne, incorporating the male and the female. And this thing is about 40 or 50 feet high, and it's carved out of solid rock. The whole temple is carved out of a mountaintop. It's hollowed out, and you go in, and there are these magnificent, tremendous sculptures, absolutely overpowering. And to see this thing that I had always had as a kind of fantasy image was really quite tremendous. Yes?
Do you know what date would have been done, the androgyny?
No, I don't.
I think it's about the 3rd century. Or 300.
I think it was about the
3rd century. Uh-huh. That may very well be. I know it's very old, and it's just tremendously impressive to be there because you have to climb up this huge mountain, and then you go into this kind of dark place, and as your eyes become accustomed to it, and there are places where it's cut open and the light does come in, you see these ageless figures, and you really feel that you're in the presence of the archetypes. It's so impressive. Next one, please. And here's a beautiful little statue, again of Shiva as androgynous. And you see the wonderful curvaceous hip on one side and a very slender masculine with a broader shoulder on the other, and with this wonderful feeling of that harmony, and the male side is unclothed and there is this gentle covering over the leg on the female side. And, the manner is just so beautifully expressed. So this is the androgyne in a very, very lovely and felicitous form, but now I'm going to show you one that's rather terrifying. Next slide. And here you have the, this is also a Hindu one, but they also knew the tyranny of the uncontrolled animus in the woman that is very threatening. I'm sure some man had a terrible problem with his mother before he did this one. So now we can go on. Beyond the interaction between the sexes to that last, next slide please, to that last part of life where the image of returning into the darkness comes about. And here we have, that's pretty clear, death revealing the solar stone. This is an alchemical picture you'll recognize. The solar stone, or the dark cave, which is going to lead to the light finally. In Hinduism, creation and generation were not separated. The spirit and body were seen as complementary opposites that were able to unite. And the sexual organs were then worshipped, or images of them were worshipped, as symbolic of that process. Sometimes in India, you will go into a temple of Shiva, and there will be the lingam, the male sex organ, or a stylized version of it, and there'll be no sculpture or anything else. That is it. And that is the generative power of the universe. And it's garlanded with flowers, and people put rice and perfume and all of that. They really are worshiping that creativity, which is exemplified there. When I was last in India, I was particularly struck by how the names of the gods and goddesses are everywhere. You'll see Ganesha's shoe store and Shakti's ladies' dress shop and all this kind of thing. And you know, it's really kind of interesting because it's as though we went around in the West calling ourselves El or Elohim or Jesus or Allah, which of course we don't find to be exactly in keeping with our tradition. But in India, it's not a vulgarization, but it's a sense of the divine presence in the everyday life of people. It's not something that's kept separate and it's walled off in a certain building for a certain time of the week to be experienced. And even in their dance performances, the Hindu dance is often a sacred dance, which is performed as a kind of ritual symbolic of the relationship between human beings and God, and of human love in these dances, or even in theatrical performances sometimes, are metaphors for divine love. So we see that all the mysteries connected with human experience, we see there very clearly the sacred dimension. Another slide, please. And here again, there's an alchemical image of going back into that other dimension, into what may be the implicate order, or the black sun. The bright sun is the world of emergence. And now we have the image of the black sun, which would correspond perhaps to our images in physics of the black hole. And then there's the final liberation after that. All right, we might have a few questions and a short break and then come back. So I'm open for some questions. Gods and goddesses sometimes represented with lots of hands. And sometimes there will be eight of them, you know. And they're all multi-determined. They all do all kinds of things. Yes. I see it as neither one. I see it as facilitating. Because if there were not destruction, there could be no creativity. There is a wonderful section in Blake where he talks about the prolific and the devourer. Wherever there's creativity, there has to be a destruction. I think that I was really talking about that initially when I was talking about the gardening, that in order for things to grow, there has to be a cutting away. In order for life to continue, there has to be death. We have to die off and make room for the next generation. But don't worry about that, because we'll probably all be reborn into the next generation to have it go at it again. But we've got to leave these bodies. There's got to be destruction. Before you can move on in your life, you have to let go of the past. Well, you mean when people hurt each other and damage each other? And that's a really interesting and difficult question. I would like to believe that we will evolve to the place where everybody will love each other and there won't be any destruction or destructive behavior. But as I look back on my own life, which goes quite a way back now, I notice that some of the experiences which at the time seem most destructive are the ones from which I've learned the most. And the places where I slid by in sweetness and light turn out to be pretty vapid. And there's a wonderful old story, a Chinese story, I don't remember too well, but where a man's gets a horse, he's given a horse, and all his friends say, "Isn't that wonderful?" And then the horse runs away, and they say, "Oh, this is terrible, we're so sorry." And then the horse comes back with two or three others, and now he's got three horses, and they say, "Isn't it wonderful?" And then his son gets up on a horse and falls down and breaks his leg, and they say, "Oh, isn't it terrible?" And then there is a call for people in the army, and every young man gets taken except the boy who has broken his leg, and they say, "Oh, isn't that wonderful?" And it goes on and on and on like that. So the moral being, obviously, that what appears to be destructive may not always be destructive. For example, the threat of the nuclear bomb may be the one thing that brings nations into a trusting relationship with each other, because if we don't, we know that none of us will survive. So that whole business of what is destructive, very interesting question. Yes. Well, that's a hard thing to know for sure. He did talk about the archetypes rather early, and he was quite a scholar. As a young man, before he decided to be a doctor, you remember, he studied anthropology and archaeology, and so he must have been in touch with ideas that inspired that. And I have to say that when we get a core idea in our lives, we sort of tune into that. Then you go out into the world, and you keep finding things to reinforce that. And so it kind of That's interesting. And we talk about it a little later when we talk about morphic resonance, how you get tuned into something and it plays back to you all the time. Okay, I would like to take a little break now. Let's take about 10 minutes.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.